And basically, we see the screen. We see my screen right now. We should be, everyone can hear. And so, yeah, go ahead, whoever is going to do the meeting stuff.
Well, the first thing is whether anyone has an announcement they'd like to make. Jim.
As you probably read in the newsletter, dues are now due. I accept checks in the mail. I will accept PayPal payments. Go through the website, please, rather than trying to send them to me directly. And we also, is it Zelle or Zelle or Venmo, one of the other means of transferring money. I haven't seen anybody try that one yet. But yes, dues are due, and I would appreciate seeing some money flow in. Thank you.
Jim, did you get my
$10
check?
this year, right?
I received yours, Norm. Jeffrey.
Okay, very good.
Are there any other announcements?
Yeah, we do have the Exploring the Sky. That's coming up on, let's see, when is that? That is going to be on the 23rd of September at the usual spot, and it will be preceded by a planetarium show at the National Park Service's Nature Center. And the time for the Exploring the Sky is 8 o'clock, and the planetarium show will start an hour before that at 7 o'clock. Those are quite popular, that is, if the weather cooperates.
You had a huge attendance the last time, didn't you?
We had a what?
A huge attendance.
Yeah, it was quite popular. It's the longest running such thing. Program with the National Park Service anywhere in the country, as far as I know, even though it's not the greatest place to observe from, obviously. But there are a
West
lot
of
of
England.
people that that's the only place they can observe from. They don't
Right.
have a telescope, they don't have access to a dark sky location. And you can still see things from there and show
Ah.
people stuff that they've never seen before.
Are there any other announcements?
I'm expecting the planetarium at Montgomery College to be open in March, I've been told, of 2024. We have a
Wonderful.
dome, but we don't yet have the projectors and the computers. And I spent 2 weeks in Pennsylvania and New Jersey learning how to use the new software and being impressed.
I have one small announcement and then I'll introduce the speaker. We really need someone who is willing to be a candidate for vice president in the election this June. The main activity in that job is recruiting and introducing speakers. I'll help whoever volunteers, but we really do need someone to take over on that. Well, it's a great pleasure to introduce Dr. Dana Anderson, a postdoctoral researcher in the Earth and Planets Laboratory of the Carnegie Institution for Science in Washington. She has a bachelor's in chemistry and in interdisciplinary physics from University of Michigan and a PhD in planetary science from Caltech. She has done a postdoc in research at the University of Virginia and is now a postdoc at the Carnegie Institution in Washington, where she's part of a team with Alicia Weinberger and Johanna Teske, who have both previously spoken to us. Dana's research focuses on both the chemistry and origin of planets and planetary systems. She's also a talented artist, and the subject of her art are often connected to her research. Today she'll tell us about how we identify the chemical ingredients that make planets and what that information tells us about where our solar system came from and how our solar system may differ from the wide variety of planetary systems that form around other stars in our galaxy. And it also tells us about the chemical signatures that indicate whether an extrasolar planet might be habitable. Dana.
Thank you, John, for that wonderful introduction. Let me share my slide. All right. Does it look like I'm sharing the right screen?
No.
All right. Yes, today I'm here to talk about the chemical ingredients that make planets. So a little bit about me. John has already gone over most of this, but I am a postdoctoral fellow at the Carnegie Institution for Science in Washington, D.C. My career trajectory has taken me all over the United States, from Michigan to California to Virginia to D.C. My main research interests are astrochemistry, which blends the fields of chemistry and astronomy in order to study a variety of different things in outer space. But in particular, I'm interested in learning about how planets form and how we get planets that are something like our own Earth. I'm originally from the state of Michigan, where I grew up water skiing and snowmobiling. And I don't have any plants, I don't have any pets, so I included a picture of my spider plant. So my work is motivated by a few big questions in astronomy. And these questions are, how did life originate on Earth? And does life exist anywhere else? And this could have been life that existed in the past, life that is existing in the present, or life that could develop around other stars in our galaxy in the future. These are very complex questions to answer. So therefore, we need to take an interdisciplinary approach, combining astronomy with other sciences like physics, chemistry, geology, and biology in order to tackle these really big questions. My work uses a combination of astronomy and chemistry in a subfield known as astrochemistry to tackle just a small part of these questions. We can break down these larger questions into smaller questions, ones that we can address with astrochemistry. And so these questions might look like something like, where did the chemical ingredients for life come from? And what is the likelihood of forming Earth-like planets that contain these ingredients? And to start, we're going to talk about the elements carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, because these are all important elements for life on Earth. There are many other elements that are also important, but these are less abundant and even more complex to investigate. So we're going to start with just these three. And in order to understand where the Earth's carbon, nitrogen, oxygen came from, and what is the likelihood that Earth-like planets forming around other stars could attain similar amounts of carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, we first have to think about where the Earth itself came from. So there are multiple stages that contribute to the formation of a planet and determine its final chemical composition. These involve the initial accretion of materials by the planet from its surroundings, followed by the mixing and processing and separation of these materials within the planet, and then a later stage of delivery of materials to the fully formed planet by impacts onto the planet's surface from bodies like asteroids and comets. And to understand where Earth's carbon, nitrogen, oxygen came from and how much is generally available to Earth-like planets across the galaxy, we have to determine how materials containing these three elements are gained or lost throughout each of these stages. And we have to track these chemical ingredients throughout the process of planet formation. Today, the Earth sits in our solar system orbiting the sun at a distance of 93 million miles. This distance is also referred to as one astronomical unit, or AU, which is a unit that I will used throughout this talk. It's one of four rocky planets that make up the inner solar system, with four larger gas giant planets further out. And this is roughly what our solar system is organized like today. But if we go back in time, over 4.6 billion years, it would look very different, something more like this, where our young sun sits in the middle of a large disk of dust and gas that surrounds it. And it was out of this disk material that the planets formed. And this disk is known as a protoplanetary disk or planet-forming disk. And this is mostly what I study in my work. So this process that forms a protoplanetary disk and eventually a planetary system didn't occur just around our star, but for a wide variety of stars across our galaxy. And although the formation of a protoplanetary disk is common to all stars, it's not clear whether or not all stars will also form planets. So figuring out which initial conditions lead to planet formations and which ones don't is one of the goals of my work. So in order to understand how the Earth and other Earth-like planets might obtain the ingredients necessary for life, we want to track the availability of these elements throughout the materials that go into forming both the protoplanetary disk and eventually planets. And so this starts from material in the interstellar medium, which is the space between the stars, out of which both stars and eventually planets will form. And so a dense clump of this material will collapse over time, eventually forming a star surrounded by a protoplanetary disk of material out of which the gas and dust components of the disk will have very different evolutions. So the gaseous material will accrete onto the central star, be collected into gas giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn in our own solar system, and eventually be lost to space. As you see in our own solar system, there isn't a lot of gas left around except in the gas giant planets. Meanwhile, the solid components of the disk, the small dust grains and ices, follow a different path where they collide and collect together, forming larger and larger bodies, eventually something like the size of comets and asteroids, and then even larger into rocky planets like Earth and the solid cores of giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn. And eventually, after all of this evolution, we will end up with a planetary system that looks something like our own solar system. We want to understand throughout all of these processes what's happening to the important chemical elements like carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen in order to determine how much can end up on a planet like our Earth. So while the protoplanetary disk out of which our solar system formed is long gone, we can observe examples of what it might have been like by looking at young stars that are currently going through their protoplanetary disk stage. So it's sort of like trying to figure out what an adult used to be like by studying a group of babies. We can't go back in time and see what that particular adult looked like as a baby, but we can guess what they would have been like by spending time with people who are currently babies. So there are several hundreds of these baby systems in our nearby galaxy that we have begun to study through observations. And 20 of them are shown in these images here, which are showing the distribution of millimeter-sized dust. So each of these would have a star in the center with the protoplanetary disk dust glowing here around it. And as you can see by looking at this image, these 20 disks all look very different. They have a lot of different structures. Some have large gaps in them, some don't. They're a variety of different sizes, and some of them even have these spiral structures within them. And so what we want to understand is if all of these planet-forming regions look different, how does that translate into forming different types of planets and planetary systems? So around the stars throughout our galaxy, over 5,000 exoplanets have been discovered, And we expect that there are many more that we haven't been able to see yet with our current telescope facility. And what we've found through all of these observations is that planetary systems are common across the galaxy, but often they look very different from our own solar system. In some cases, there are large planets like Jupiter that are very close to their star, even interior to the orbit of Mercury. And in addition, there are some planets that orbit their stars at very weird angles where our solar system is relatively flat. In addition, one of the most common types of planets that's been discovered is something that is actually between the size of Earth and Neptune, which is a type of planet that we don't have in our own solar system. So we see that there's this wide variety of different outcomes of the planet formation process. And one of our goals in studying protoplanetary disks is understanding how the variety of different protoplanetary disk structures and the differences in these initial conditions result in the wide variety of exoplanetary systems that have been observed. In addition, when we think about the bodies just within our own solar system, there we also see a ton of diversity. The planets like Earth and Mars look very different from planets like Jupiter and Saturn, which are much bigger and composed mostly of gas. In addition, we have planetary bodies like comets and asteroids, which are a variety of sizes and have very different compositions from either Earth or Jupiter and the other planets. So we want to understand within the protoplanetary disk, if you're forming at different locations in the disk, how does that determine the size and chemical composition of the body that you're going to form so that we can explain how we ended up with this variety of bodies in our solar system. So some ways that we can connect protoplanetary disks to their eventual planetary outcomes, what shapes and sizes or shapes of systems and sizes and chemical compositions of planets that you'll form, we can look at a few of these fundamental properties of protoplanetary disks that directly relate to the types of planets that they might be able to form. So one of these properties is the mass of the protoplanetary disk, so the total amount of material that is present around the young star out of which planets can form. So this will determine the total amount of mass that individual planets can have that form out of the disk, and then also the number and sizes of these planets. In addition, the composition of the protoplanetary disk will set the composition of the planets that form. So the gases in the disk will contribute to the atmospheres of gas giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn. Meanwhile, the solids will contribute to the sizes of the rocky cores in these gas giant planets, terrestrial planets like the Earth, which is mostly composed of solids, and then planetary debris like comets and asteroids in the system. And finally, the lifetime of the protoplanetary disk will tell you about the timescale available for gas giant planet formation, because once all of the gas has disappeared from the disk, then you can no longer form these large gaseous planets. In addition, the amount of gas that's present in the disk can control the different types of planets that you might form through different planet formation theories. So it really helps us to better understand how planets form in general. And all three of these fundamental properties of protoplanetary disks are something that we observe through emission from molecules in the disk gas. So the molecules in the gas give off light that we can then observe with telescopes and use to probe these different properties of the disk. So when we're thinking about protoplanetary disks, we really need to understand their chemistry in order to get at these properties like their mass, chemical composition, and gas lifetime. And in order to understand the chemistry, first we have to understand the physical structure of the disk. So here I'm showing a drawing of a vertical slice through the protoplanetary disk where we have the star at the center and the disk material flaring out at both sides. And in the disk, we have different regions. So the midplane of the disk is where the planets will form. It's the densest with the most material. And so we expect planets to form here. Meanwhile, the surface layers that spread out from the midplane are highly irradiated from the light that comes off of the central star. In addition, we have different regions of the disk. The inner disk, which is roughly where terrestrial planets like the Earth form around 1 AU. And then as you go out further to the outer disk, there we have different planet forming conditions where you might get planets like Jupiter and Saturn roughly out at 5 to 10 AU, and then even further regions of the disk beyond where we have planets in our own solar system. And the basic composition of the disk is that the vast majority of the material is molecular hydrogen, with a relatively small amount of solid material that's concentrated in these tiny dust grains that are only roughly a micron in size. And out of all that tiny dust grains, we eventually have to form things as large as the Earth, which is kind of crazy to think about. And when we get to the types of elements that I'm interested in studying, like carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, this is even a tinier fraction of the total material in the disk. So only 1 in 10,000 atoms in the protoplanetary disk is going to be carbon, nitrogen, or oxygen, relative to most of the disk being made of hydrogen. And so if you've taken a chemistry class recently, you might recall that many chemical reactions depend on both pressure and temperature in order to determine how fast they're carried out. And so when we're thinking about chemistry in protoplanetary disks, we want to think about the pressures and temperatures that are present. So on the left side of this image, I'm showing roughly the density of material, which tells you about the pressure. And on the right side, I have the temperature. And what you can see is that due to the presence of the central star, you get a wide variety of different densities and pressures throughout the disk structure. In addition, we have stellar radiation and high energy particles and radiation that comes from the surrounding interstellar medium, which also affects the chemistry. So as a result, we end up with a variety of different chemical zones throughout the disk, where you have the surface layers, which are highly irradiated by the central star. So you have photons flying in, breaking down all of the molecules, resulting in ionized material and also neutral atoms. But then the material is shielded as you get in closer to the midplane where planets form, and you can have these larger molecules built up and even eventually ices in the cooler outer regions of the disk. So what this means effectively is that depending on where in the disk you're forming, you have very different chemical ingredients available to you as a forming planet. So in the inner regions of the disk, you're going to have most of your materials available in the gas because it's hotter and everything is volatilized and present in the gas. Whereas if you're further away from the central star, at cooler temperatures, then some of these chemical species are going to freeze out into ices, and you have much more solid material available to form disks. And eventually, when we're thinking about what's going to be available to forming Earth-like planets versus forming something further out, you're going to have a very different set of chemical ingredients in each of these cases. And so it's very important that we understand this chemical layout of the protoplanetary disk in order to understand what planets that form in different locations are going to be made of. So how do we study protoplanetary disks? In my work, we use a combination of computational models in addition to observations from telescopes in order to study protoplanetary disks. And so we model the chemistry and then compare with what we observe from light coming off of molecules throughout the disk gas with our telescopes, and sort of go back and forth. And the models inform what we look for in the observations, and the observations then constrain our models. And in particular, two major players in studying protoplanetary right now are the James Webb Space Telescope, which was launched on December 25th, 2021, and has been carrying out observations for over a year. It's produced many big headlines recently in the news and is doing a lot of exciting science that's particularly important for studying the chemistry of protoplanetary disks. In addition, another powerhouse in studying protoplanetary disk chemistry is the Atacama Large Millimeter / Submillimeter Array, or ALMA. And ALMA is a set of 66 radio antennas that all work together as a single telescope. So effectively, it's acting as a much larger dish, but because they're all separate telescopes, those are smaller and much more feasible to build. And so you're getting this powerful set of powerful observations from this large network of telescopes. And even more important than that is really the location at where they're built is a very dry place high in the Atacama Desert in Chile, which gives you unprecedented ability to make these types of observations. So in terms of computational modeling, as you saw in the previous slide, there are many different processes and components of the disk structure that go into determining the disk chemistry. So we end up using a series of different computational models in order to eventually predict the chemistry throughout the disk. And so we have models that include the propagation of photons throughout the disk, and then also separate models that have a series of chemical reactions to predict the gas temperatures and also the chemistry throughout the disk. And through using these models, we can test a variety of different inputs, modeling different types of stars, different sizes of disks, and also starting with different input chemical ingredients to turn all these knobs and see what different types of chemistries we can end up with in our model. And then we pair this with observations of protoplanetary disks. So if we were studying the composition of bodies in our solar system, we might be able to send a space mission there to go and collect a sample. But since these disks are much too far away for that, we really only have the light that comes from the molecules in these systems that we can collect from our telescopes in order to study these disks. So the light that we see with our eyes is in the visible range of the spectrum, but there's also light at shorter wavelengths and longer wavelengths that we can't see, but there are telescopes that are designed to collect the light at these wavelengths. Meanwhile, molecules in the gas give off light at specific wavelengths, and we can use these wavelengths as a chemical fingerprint in order to figure out which molecules are present in the gas. In particular, molecules emit in the infrared, which is observable with the James Webb Space Telescope, and also at millimeter/submillimeter wavelength, which is observable with ALMA. And we can combine observations from these two telescopes to get different views of the protoplanetary disk. And so we get different types of data from different telescopes. Here I'm showing a recent spectrum from a protoplanetary disk taken by JWST. And you can see from their corresponding model which types of molecular species are providing the emission seen in the spectrum. And so you can see a variety of oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen-bearing species that we can directly observe from these protoplanetary disks. In addition, we can get different information from telescopes like ALMA, where here we're looking at the same disk in emission from a wide variety of different molecules. And as you can see, it looks very different depending on which molecule you're looking at. And so this depends on both the temperature, determining how well the molecule gives off light, and also the distribution of the molecule throughout the disk. But here you can see that we have a wealth of information to work with and to compare with our models to really understand the chemical composition of these planet-forming regions. And so it's important that we use these different facilities because they probe different parts of the disk. So infrared observatories like JWST and Spitzer before it probe the inner regions of protoplanetary disk, somewhere like roughly around where the Earth formed. But the outer regions of the disk are much colder, so they don't give off emission at the wavelengths that are observable by JWST and Spitzer. So instead, we probe the outer regions of the disk with telescopes like ALMA. And we really need to combine observations from both of these in order to probe the entire disk. But at the same time, the very interior parts of the disk, the material there is so dense that it's hard for photons to escape. So there's certain regions of the disk that we can't probe at all through our telescope observations. So here we actually rely on information from the composition of planets and planetary bodies in our own solar system, and also what we can learn from exoplanets in order to get at the material in the deepest parts of the protoplanetary disk. So it's really a comparison of what we think was there based on what we can observe that ended up in these bodies today. So we really have to piece together information from all these sources to back out the composition of these planet-forming regions. So if we return to our fundamental properties of protoplanetary disks that we want to understand so that we can understand which types of planets form from them, let's start with the mass of protoplanetary disks. So while you would think that the mass of a disk would be something that's relatively easy to do because you're essentially just counting up the total amount of gas molecules that are present in the disk, the problem is actually more difficult than it sounds. And to explain that, I'm going to use this example. So let's say you were standing up on a stage and I asked you to count the number of people in the room. You would say, well, that's relatively easy. I'll just start counting. But then I turned off the light. So you know there's a bunch of people in this room in front of you, but you can't actually see them. So how are you supposed to count the number of people if you can't see them? But then as you peer into the darkness, you actually notice that there's a few people that you can see because they're wearing glow-in-the-dark clothing. This is a very small number of people relative to the total, but you can use, if you count this number of people, and then estimate roughly the fraction of people who wear glow-in-the-dark clothing relative to the total, how many total people are present in the room. And that's roughly what we're doing in order to estimate protoplanetary disk gases. Because the problem we have is that the vast majority of gas in protoplanetary disks is stored in molecular hydrogen. And molecular hydrogen doesn't emit light under protoplanetary disk conditions, so we can't see it. But we can observe particular molecules like CO or carbon monoxide. It is a bright molecule, easily observable, but it's a very small fraction of the total amount of material in the disk, something like 1 in 10,000 relative to the H2, and in some systems, even less than that. And so the trick is that we can measure the amount of CO emission to understand how much CO mass is present, but then we really need to estimate this fraction of CO relative to H2 in order to back out the total amount of material present. And so that's where my work comes in, where I use a third molecular species present in the disk, which is N2H+, or diazine helium. And this molecule is actually sensitive to the ratio of CO relative to H2 that we need in order to get our total masses. And so if we observe both N2H+ and CO in the disk, we can actually back out the CO relative to H2 fraction and get the total disk gas mass. And so when we do this, we can measure the masses of protoplanetary disks for a variety of disks in different parts of the observable galaxy around us. And we can make comparisons like this. So here I'm showing the total amount of gas in the disk relative to ages of different systems. And each of the colors is also showing disks that form within the same star-forming region, so relatively the same environment. And for comparison, in terms of the disk gas masses, I plotted this line here for the total amount of gas that it takes to make one Jupiter, or that is composed in one Jupiter-sized planet. And then each of these tick marks correspond to a factor of 10 higher. So 10 Jupiters, 100 Jupiters, and 1,000 Jupiters. In reality, the planet formation process is not 100% efficient, so you can't technically make 1,000 Jupiters out of this, but it gives you some sense of the fact that you can still make planets out of these larger systems, and it gets much harder when you move down to smaller masses. But the big takeaway from this plot is just that the mass in protoplanetary disks varies wildly, even within disks that are roughly about the same age or form in the same region. So we're seeing that different systems are evolving on different timescales and have very different potentials for eventually forming planets. And so this is a relatively small sample, but we're actually getting a much larger sample of 80 protoplanetary disks with the ALMA telescope coming in the near future. So we'll have a much better ability to characterize the amount of material in these disks in order to determine how often they have enough to form planets or not. The second fundamental parameter of protoplanetary disks that we care about is their composition. And now when we think about composition, we can start out from theory, thinking about what materials we inherited from the earlier stages into the disk and what we expect to happen to them based on the conditions present in the disk. So we expect, for the case of carbon, that about half of the carbon that is introduced into the disk will be in some solid form. And we expect that throughout most of the disk, it will remain in solid form and only be vaporized into the gas at very high temperatures. And so this means that if you're forming a solid planet like the Earth, if you form anywhere out beyond about half an AU, you expect it to be very carbon rich, have a lot of carbon in its structure. But if you formed even closer to the sun, then you would expect this carbon to only be in the gas, not be in the solid. So if you're forming a solid planet, you would have very little carbon in its structure. And we can do the same type of activity for the gaseous form of carbon in the disk, where here we expect that it will remain in the gas form throughout most of the disk and only freeze out in ice at very large distances from the central star. And so we would expect that if you're forming a gas-rich planet, it would have a lot of carbon in its gas in these interior regions. And if it formed further out, there would be more carbon in the solids, but not as much in its gaseous atmosphere. But when we take this picture of our expectations and compare it with actual data and observations, we see that it's much more complicated than that. So while we expected that planets that formed in this interior region of the disk of a few or more AU to have a lot of carbon in their structure, what we actually see is that they contain very little carbon. So you would think, you know, carbon is important for life on Earth, but that means that the Earth has a lot of it. But compared to the initial materials that it formed from, it actually has more than 1,000 times less carbon than you would expect. So there's actually been a lot of carbon that was removed from the solids prior to the Earth forming. And so that's a bit of a mystery of where is all this carbon going? And now it's not entirely clear at what point in the disk we expect to have carbon-rich solids versus all of that carbon being present in the gas. In addition, for the DO carbon in the disk, we had expected that interior to the point where CO froze out at low temperatures, that this interior part of the disk would be very CO rich. But in fact, when we look at protoplanetary disk observations, we see much less CO than we expected. And so it's instead thought that there's a lot more carbon in these solids or in some other carbon carrying molecule. And so this carbon is in effect missing from where we expected it to be. And so then when we're thinking about forming Earth-like planets at roughly 1 AU from the central star, It's unclear whether the gas is going to be carbon rich or the solids are going to be carbon rich. We don't know entirely what to expect in terms of where the carbon will be present at this distance when you're forming Earth-like planets. But that's something that the James Webb Space Telescope will be able to tell us about. So in my work in preparation for JWST observations, I ran computer simulations starting with different protoplanetary disk compositions and predicted what the JWST spectra would look like. So starting from different initial chemical ingredients and using our model to predict spectra, we were able to come up with these simulations, which show a bright emission coming from various oxygen and carbon-bearing molecules. And using this emission and comparing with JWST observations, we'll be able to infer the chemical composition of protoplanetary disks in these inner regions close to where we expect planets like the Earth to form. So finally, when we're thinking about the lifetime of protoplanetary disks, we can learn about this by looking at a variety of populations of stars at different ages. So here, this plot is showing ages of different star forming regions. And what people do in order to determine the disk lifetime is they look at the stars in these different regions and determine how many have evidence of protoplanetary disks. And then you look at the fraction of protoplanetary disks over time and determine the rough lifetime of these systems. But these types of studies are done for in the near infrared, which tracks dust in the very interior of these disks close to the star. So if we're interested in gas throughout the entire protoplanetary disk, it's still an open question about how long that gas lingers. So as you can see, for the dust, it sort of drops off on this time scale of a few to several million years. But for the gas, we actually have some systems at this corner of the plot of 10 million years in age that we expect that all of the protoplanetary disk material, including the gas, has completely disappeared. But in fact, sensitive observations have been able to detect a small amount of CO, carbon monoxide gas, in these systems. So we want to understand, is it common for protoplanetary disks to have gas out to these ages, or are these some types of outliers or anomalies, or is in fact this gas coming from somewhere else and not even from the protoplanetary disk at all? So two different possible origins of this gas are: one, that this gas is left over from the earlier gas-rich protoplanetary disk stage that's just sort of disappearing over time, but still present at this 10 million year age. Or the second scenario, where the protoplanetary disk gas has completely disappeared, but we've regenerated new gas through collisions of comet-like bodies around the star. And so we expect that these two different scenarios will have very different compositions. The first scenario, which I sort of cutely named the ghost scenario because it's this lingering leftover material from the protoplanetary disk, we expect to have a protoplanetary disk-like composition, which is rich in molecular hydrogen and relatively poor in things like water and CO. Meanwhile, in the second scenario, where you have the gas that is regenerated from collisions with comets, which I have cutely named the zombie scenario, where you're bringing the gas back to life, we expect that this gas has a comet-like composition, which is actually poor in molecular hydrogen, but rich in things like water and CO. And so using the chemistry of this gas, we can potentially distinguish between these two scenarios and determine whether we have protoplanetary disks that are actually living out to 10 million years old, or whether the gas is completely gone and it's just anomalous gas regenerated from comet collisions that we're seeing at this 10 million year age. And so to distinguish these two different scenarios, we turn back to my favorite friend, N2H+. This molecular tracer is able to distinguish these two scenarios because the chemistry determines that we will likely form it, and it will be very abundant in molecular hydrogen-rich gas, like in a protoplanetary disk, But in a comet-like composition gas, we don't expect to form N2H+. So we can use the presence of N2H+ to distinguish between these two scenarios. And so in my work, we looked at two disks plotted here that are roughly 10 million years old. And as you can see, compared to the disks shown in blue, which are protoplanetary disks, these two disks have very small dust fluxes. So they have much less millimeter-sized dust, suggesting that they have evolved to a later state of evolution. But mysteriously, they have a similar amount of CO gas in their systems compared to the protoplanetary disks. But when we looked for N2H+, we actually didn't detect it in either of these systems. So this suggests that the CO gas that's present is actually the zombie gas that was regenerated from comet collisions rather than gas that was left over from protoplanetary disks. So this helps us understand what the maximum lifetime is of protoplanetary disks, suggesting that it's probably less than this 10 million year age. And so that brings me to my summary. Probing the basic characteristics of protoplanetary disks really requires having an understanding of both the physical and chemical environments present within them. We can use a combination of computational models and observations at different wavelengths in order to constrain the distribution of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen throughout these planet-forming environments. And tracking the chemistry within these disks is really important for connecting the composition of protoplanetary disk materials to the different types of planets that we might be able to form within these regions. So thank you for listening, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions?
Any questions from in here?
I have one. It's a bit far out. About H2, the dominant version is a proton in both nuclei, but there probably are some that are have a proton in one and a deuterium in the other. And it wouldn't be abundant, but it would even have a small electric dipole moment, which the H2 doesn't, except in dense atmospheres like Jupiter, where pressure distorts it. So I doubt that there's any data on detections of that kind of H2, but it might be something to consider.
There actually is. So we have a very small number of disks where HD has been detected, and it is detectable. And like you said, it's much less abundant. So it's back to, you have to understand the fraction of HD to H2 in order to back up the H2 mass. But it has been used in order to estimate these masses. The problem is that we were able to measure HD when the Herschel Space Observatory was still active. But now that that mission is over, we don't currently have any observing facilities that can observe at the right wavelength to measure HD. So that's something that astrochemists, particularly in the protoplanetary disk community, are really advocating for, is a future space mission that will be able to measure HD, because that is a really powerful tool for being able to get at these disk masses.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I know sometimes we're called a double planet because of the Earth and the Moon and the importance that the Moon has to the Earth. And does any of your work or work of other scientists doing this kind of study talk about how these double planets are formed? Where they've is this very uncommon? Anyway, that's my question.
Yeah, so moon formation is actually really interesting because there's a variety of different ways in which moons can form. It's still thought that our moon formed from a colliding body into the Earth, producing either something that broke off or some like disk around the Earth out of which the moon eventually formed. There's still a lot to be figured out about that. But you also can have moon formation around planets like Jupiter, where you actually think there was a disk of material around the planet, somewhat similar to the protoplanetary disk that I study around stars. So that's an active area of research, actually, where people are trying to look at these circumplanetary disks with observatories like ALMA. And there's very little information we can get about them right now, other than they exist in some cases. But it's definitely an exciting area to look into for moon formation.
Any other questions?
So if you had to bet, do you think it's the zombie or the ghost scenarios?
So it does look like it's the zombie scenario right now. The really strange thing is that the only molecule we've detected in that gas so far is CO. So even other groups looking at different systems than the ones that I showed today have only been able to detect CO gas. Whereas if we expected that it's forming from comet collisions, there's a few other things like HCN that we would expect to also be able to observe, but it just hasn't been seen. So it's a bit of a chemical mystery right now how we're just getting the CO gas, but it does seem like there aren't other tracers we would expect to be there for the ghost scenario.
I've got a question, if I may. Is there a way we can determine the earliest time in the evolution of the universe that rocky planets like Earth with carbon, oxygen, and silicon would form?
That is a very good question. It's a little outside my area of expertise, but I know part of what we have to figure out is sort of what the early generations of stars looked like and how many of the heavier elements that were actually present. And how that affects forming planets, because if you don't have these heavy elements, maybe you don't have as much solid material to form planets. But yeah, that's definitely something that we need, sort of the people studying the earlier ages of the universe and the planet formation people to get together to think about.
What are the best ways to approach that problem that we have at this point?
So I don't know if there's too much we can do observationally. I think it would be a little bit more in terms of thinking about planet formation theories, and if you injected the very different amounts of gas versus dust and different chemical, you know, availability of different chemical elements, depending on what we thought was there in the early generations of star formation. I think that would be the way to approach it.
Okay, thank you.
I was initially going to ask about what about the migration of planets, because Jupiter and Saturn have moved inward and then moved back outward. But I figured that that's too late after the ingredients to affect the ingredients.
It actually depends on when the migration happens. Some of the gas giants, there's interactions between the planet and the gas around it can actually cause some of the migration while the gas is still present. And so that's actually a real problem for trying to understand which parts of the disk the planet was collecting material from, because it's actually moving over time. And at the same time, the composition of the disk is changing over time. So it becomes a very complicated problem. And we're really just at the, you know, like stage one of, like, if we assume that everything is fixed and we form a planet exactly at this location, what would we expect its composition to be? But there's a lot of time scales and different dynamical processes that make the reality much more complicated than the simple picture.
Thank you.
Yes, we have a question here.
Yes. So why is do you we have planets like Jupiter that are solid hydrogen? Is that because of, there's a, I guess, some sort of a freezing point, kind of like what you showed with the ice? And is that kind of why we have Saturn and everything else?
Yeah, so actually the main mechanism thought for planet formation, especially based on our solar system, is that once you have the colder regions of the disk where water and other volatile species freeze out, you have much more solid material available. So you have a lot more material to form the cores that, so you have like a solid core that then gravitationally collects the gas around it. And once it gets to a certain size, you have just this rapid collapse of gas onto it that forms these giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn. And that the idea is, like you said, you need those ice lines in the disk where you have the solid material available in order to really form enough mass quickly enough to get that process going. At the same time, we have these exoplanetary systems where you see these gas giant planets in really close to their star. And so then it's kind of an open question of like, so did they form beyond their snow line in the outer disk and then migrate inwards at some point? Or did they actually form that close to their star through some other process that didn't require having the solid icy material like we thought? So that's an active area of research right now.
Sue, you have your hand raised?
Yes. Regarding the exoplanetary systems, does the wide variety of them and the fact that they are so different in most cases from our planetary system indicate that they had a very different chemical makeup in the beginning? Can you sort of extrapolate backward from that and say, oh, because they ended up this way, then they must have had a different composition than we did?
Yeah, so that's what we're trying to figure out. And it is very complicated to tie the composition and locations of planets today to where we initially thought that they formed. But that's what we're really trying to work towards, is if we start out with both the chemical composition, but then also sort of like the amount of material and how it was distributed throughout the disk, how does that end up in these different types of systems? But it does look like we're seeing a lot of diversity in protoplanetary disks at that early initial stage. And so it's likely that that diversity is also going to result in the diversity that we see in exoplanetary systems.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Mm-hmm. Pretty quiet here.
Okay.
I've got one more.
Okay, good.
I gathered from what you were saying that the gas giant planets tend to form farther out. Correct me if I'm wrong. How then is it by migration that we have these super gas giants really close into stars with orbits smaller than Mercury's?
Yeah, so migration is one possibility. The other possibility is that they form there through a very different process. And so that's something that people are sort of arguing about on the planet formation theory side, is like, can we actually form them close to their stars, or did they have to migrate? But that's also something we can investigate through the chemistry angle, because we expect planets that form in very close to their star to be forming from different chemical ingredients than the ones that form further out. So by looking at what the composition of these close-in planets are, if it doesn't match what we think should be there at that location during the planet formation stage, then we can sort of infer that they must have formed somewhere further out in the disk and then migrated in. But right, we have a lot of steps to actually be able to carry out that type of analysis.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? If not, then you can unmute yourself and we can thank the speaker again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It was super fun to talk to you guys.
Yeah, that was a particularly clear talk you gave.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, and I guess we'll see folks next month on October 14th. John, do you know if the speaker will be in person for that?
No, I have to contact them about that.
But that's Ben Horde from here.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
There's a good chance that'll be in person then, unless something comes up.
Okay. Later is Exploring the Sky, which also happens to be International Observe the Moon Night.
That's October 21st.
Yes, October 21st. Yeah.
And then October 14th, we also have the partial solar eclipse that day.
That's right. That's yes.
So lots going on.
Yeah, it's a busy month.
And I will be doing some garage sales here in a couple weekends to get rid of about 20, 30 telescopes that we've accumulated over the last couple of years. So stay tuned for that. All right. So we'll see y'all next time. Thank you for coming out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.